This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
We just need a strategy, okay?
Okay, here's the plan.
The Secretary of State, John Merrill, is now being sued by the ACLU and three Alabama citizens. We give you the details now on Tactics. Good morning. Welcome to Tactics. It is a Friday morning. We are finally at the weekend's threshold. We're almost there. One more day. Hang in there, guys. And it has been a long, long, long week, at least from a news standpoint. Although it's ironic because usually when you talk about having a long news week, and there have been ones that felt longer than this. I wouldn't say that this is the one that feels the longest or anything like that. But it's funny because typically when you're talking about having a very long news week, you mean that a lot of stories happened all at once. With this one, that's not necessarily the case. It was just one news story that everybody was talking about all at the same time. So, of course, that would be the Brett Kavanaugh thing. But one thing that we don't want to do is we don't want to ignore some of our local news that's going on, because this is of the utmost importance as well, especially since it affects you in a far more personal way. So the ACLU now, the ACLU of Alabama, has said that they and three citizens of the state of Alabama are suing the Secretary of State, John Merrill. And with these three citizens and the ACLU, their complaint is that they have been blocked from John Merrill on Twitter. No, I promise I'm not making this story up. This is actually the complaint that they have, that they are on Twitter and John Merrill has blocked them from his Twitter account. That's the thing that they're upset about. That's the thing that they're suing him over. And the argument here is that they are doing so that John Merrill blocked them specifically because of their political affiliation. And that because he was blocking them for their political affiliation, this amounts to discrimination and a violation of the First Amendment. Now, from a non-legal standpoint, just using the plain definition of words, I think that there's a decent case to be made that blocking anybody on Twitter for any reason is discrimination. I mean, let's say that you are a woman and there's a guy making lewd comments about what he wants to do to you, and you block that guy. Well, is that justified? Absolutely. I don't know of anybody on either side of the political spectrum that would at any time say that that's not something that she ought to be able to do. But nonetheless, it is technically discrimination. You are saying to some people, you are not morally fit to be on here with me, therefore I'm blocking you because of the things that you're saying, and nobody would bat an eye about that, because that is harassment. And so when we're using discrimination, I think discrimination is a word that gets thrown around far too often because it gets misused, or it gets used in the correct context like it actually is here, but it brings with it negative connotations that don't really exist. A perfect example is if your doorbell rings at 3 a.m. and you look outside and you see a dude that is dressed from head to toe in combat gear and a hockey mask, dressed like the Punisher with a bunch of guns and knives and other weapons hanging off of him. Do you let that guy in? No. If it's your nephew who has just broken down outside your house and has car trouble, then you do let that guy in. Well, that is by definition discrimination, but that doesn't mean that the discrimination in and of itself is not justified. And so that's one thing that we do need to ask this question is, when they're talking about discrimination, is the discrimination in and of itself justified? Because that's one thing that, unfortunately, when people shout discrimination, they feel like somehow they've won the argument, or that in and of itself is bad, but that's not necessarily bad. It just depends on what kind of discrimination we're talking about here. But the odd thing here, and this is what we will spend the majority of our time talking about the subject on, is that it is a, quote, violation of the First Amendment. And Brock Boone, who is an attorney with the ACLU who is helping represent these people, he's with ACLU of Alabama, said, quote, "When a government official intentionally opens up a public conversation, that official can't block individuals from joining the conversation because the views that are expressed." Yeah, that's not true. That's not even close to true. That happens all the time. When somebody in the government, whatever, whether they're a candidate, whether they're a incumbent and they already are holding office, there are a lot of times where they'll do events, for example, like a fundraising event that is invitation only. Is that a public event? Well, it's taking place at a public venue, and it's allowing members of the public in, but it's still invitation only, and there are still certain people that are not allowed into that forum. Now, there are other forums that are more public where more people are allowed, where they don't necessarily screen people for invitations or things like that, and then anybody can come in. So, yes, those events do happen. But let's not pretend as though when it comes to politicians, when they're doing either public appearances or whatever, that there is never, ever a screening process and there is never a consideration done for that. This is something that happens in a public way on many occasions. And this happens at campaign events. It happens at certain town halls. It also happens, interestingly enough, since we're on radio right now, it happens during broadcasts. Not just anybody gets to walk in, even though they are on a public forum that you can listen to as long as you have a radio or as long as you have a TV, just because they are doing an interview, for example, here in the studio with me, does not mean that anybody has the right to just walk into my radio studio and start asking John Merrill or any other elected official questions. That's not the way that it works. Or we could do that. And we could say, okay, so-and-so, you're going to come in and you're going to ask John Merrill some questions. But that doesn't mean we have to let everybody in, and that doesn't mean we can't ask that person, hey, what's your political affiliation? Now, would that be kind of underhanded? Yes. Would it be a way to lob somebody that you either like or dislike, either softball questions or questions that are going to be more confrontational? Absolutely, that would be a way to do that. But nonetheless, the fact remains that it is not a violation of the First Amendment. If I wanted to bring in somebody like John Merrill, who is a Republican, and I wanted to bring in a guest, or even several guests, that were also all Republicans and thought similarly to him, and I screened them specifically because of their political affiliation, I have the ability to do that, and John Merrill has the ability to do that. So this idea that just because it is a public forum, that there is never an occasion where it is appropriate or allowed for an elected official to ban people based on their political affiliation, first of all, is untrue. But second of all, we need to look a little bit deeper into this. So Secretary Merrill has said, quote, "I hope that what you'll do is what I've asked you to do in the past, and that's put my cell phone number in the paper, 334-328-2787. Because anyone in the state that wants to get in touch with me can call me on my cell phone. This is the bottom line. Anyone who wants to get in touch with me in this state can do so, but they don't get to choose how they get in touch with me." And that's perfectly reasonable. Elected officials are perfectly within their rights to say, I will make myself available to the public, and this is how I'm going to do it. This is a venue where I'm not going to make myself available to the public. They have the ability to do that, and you do not forego your ability to have a social media account just because you hold a public office, and to do essentially whatever you want with your own private social media account. And here's another thing. There might be some people that are looking at that and reading into that and say, oh, well, he only gave his cell phone story in response, or his cell phone number in response to this story. That's all that's going on here. He's just trying to cover his behind. No, because months before this story broke, he was on the air with me, and I did an interview with John Merrill when he was running in the Republican primary. And on that interview, you can go back and look it up, he gave out his own personal cell phone number. You can look it up at newsradio1440.com, go back through there, go on SoundCloud, search John Merrill, his interview will pop up. He gave out his personal cell phone number on the radio with me months before this happened. So this isn't him grandstanding, this isn't him trying to backtrack or cover his behind. This is the guy that he has been for as long as I have known him. He has no problem talking to constituents, people that agree with him, people that don't agree with him, Republicans, Democrats, doesn't matter. That's the kind of guy John Merrill is, and always has been, so far as I know. I mean, I can only speak for two or three years that I've known him. But this idea that he's specifically trying to not have any conversations with people on the left is simply stupid. I mean, there is no rule that says public officials have to give out their personal cell phone numbers, and most don't. And frankly, I thought it was very bold for him to do so. I don't even give out my personal cell phone number, and I'm not even an elected official. But my point in all of this is a guy who has been very transparent, has been very open to conversation, and it is ironic that this is the guy that the ACLU and these three citizens decide to go after, considering that. And Secretary Merrill also said, I want to say this was, I'm trying to remember the source on this one. It may have been Yellowhammer that I saw him make this quote on. He was talking about the reason that he blocked these people is because of some things like foul language or whatever. I want to say that was in a story. You'd have to be sure to double check me on that one. I want to hedge myself just a little bit here. But here's the thing. If that was the case and that was his motivation, that actually makes sense, because let's say that it was a completely public forum where anybody was allowed to show up. Let's say it was a town hall meeting and you get some guy that wants to ask a question of the elected official that walks up and gets to the microphone and stops dropping F-bombs left and right and saying all kinds of things, threatening people. Well, then nobody would think twice about security showing up, grabbing that guy and escorting him out. And that's what should happen, because there is a certain understanding that there needs to be some kind of decency. And also, if that person gets kicked out, then you can't say that they are doing so for political reasons. I know that a lot of people are going to make that accusation, but even here, I'm a private business. I'm a private individual. I'm not elected. I'm not the government. I work for a private, publicly traded company, Cumulus Media. And we're not in any way affiliated with the government, which means the First Amendment doesn't necessarily apply to us. We don't have to give, you know, equal time or anything to everybody. And even that, even considering that, I have been accused of censoring people because of their political affiliation when I take callers. And I tell people over and over again, it's like, look, I don't care what your political affiliation is, but you also have to abide by certain rules. There are FCC regulations that you have to abide by, and then there are certain personal rules that I hold people to when I take callers. And I don't see why John Merrill would be any different. Now, he is with the government, which means the standards have to be a little bit stricter on him. But as far as what he's talking about, if he blocked them for the reasons that people are saying, where it has to do with foul language, I don't see how that in any way is blocking them for their political affiliation. And frankly, if he was blocking them for their political affiliation, I still don't see how that would be a violation of the First Amendment. It's his Twitter account. And so we'll sort this out a little bit more and talk a little bit more about this. I'd love to hear your opinions about it. 860-1440 if you want to chime in about it. We'll be back in just a moment.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
The Bible is a book worth more than all the other books that were ever printed. Patrick Henry.
Welcome back. You're listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. We've been talking before the break, and if you do want to weigh in on this, 860-1440 is the way to get in. And we were talking before the break about John Merrill, who is now going to be sued by three Alabama citizens and the ACLU of Alabama, claiming that he was involved in a free speech violation, a First Amendment violation, when he blocked three citizens in the state of Alabama on Twitter. I'm not kidding. This is a real story. As ridiculous as it sounds, it really is. And I would be saying exactly the same thing if it were some Democrat elected official. The idea that you must provide a platform for somebody, and that is part of the First Amendment, is just insane. You guys know what a defender of the First Amendment I am. I've been very, very consistent on this. The First Amendment is my bread and butter. It is what allows me to have a job. And if it goes away, there's a good chance somebody in power somewhere will not like it and come after me. And so I am a big, big, big believer in the First Amendment. Yet, I don't like it when people claim that the First Amendment violations have taken place where it is clear that none has. And this is a situation where that is taking place. The First Amendment, first of all, applies to the federal government. And so that's the first problem with this argument that John Merrill somehow violated the First Amendment. And I know that this is an unpopular stance. There are even Republicans that disagree with me on this. But if you look at the history, if you look at the context, and if you understand how the Bill of Rights was originally intended to act as a shackle on the federal government, not the state government, then it is easy to see that even if that were the case, it wouldn't apply to John Merrill because he is a state official, not a federal employee. And to prove my point on this, what else is in the First Amendment? Freedom of religion, right? Governments are not allowed to have a state have an actual religion, a national religion. They're not allowed to make laws respecting an establishment of religion. We all understand that one, right? Well, did you know that at the signing of the Bill of Rights, there were four state governments that still had state churches? Four of them. Out of the 13 colonies which became states, there were four of them that still had state religions when the Bill of Rights was signed. And most of them retained that for decades after the Bill of Rights. It was a long time before they got rid of having an official state religion. And I believe one was like almost into the 1900s, if I'm not mistaken. I think it was it Massachusetts? No, it may have been Maryland. It may have been Maryland that retained its actual official state religion for a long time. But the point is, the First Amendment was always intended to apply specifically to the federal government, not act as a shackle for the state governments. Now, in principle, you know how I feel about free speech and that nobody in any government at any level should try to stifle it. I'm just saying that as an overall argument, looking at it from a purely legal perspective, first of all, you could argue that it's not even a violation of the First Amendment because John Merrill himself is not a federal employee. But that aside, even if you assume that that was not true, John Merrill not listening to somebody is not the same as silencing their speech, because that's essentially what happens when you block somebody on Twitter. You can't see them and they can't see you. And so John Merrill essentially decided, just like everybody else that blocked somebody on Twitter, that he did not want to see posts from this person, and so what he did was he blocked them. And so that being said, I don't understand why someone would believe that that is silencing someone's speech. If any elected official, we could use John Merrill or we could use any other elected official, let's say KIV or, any of the state or senators or House representatives, if we're talking about Clyde Chambliss or we're talking about even somebody like Senator Brubaker, any of these guys, if they meet some random person on the street and that person demands that they speak to them about politics, if they walk away, are they silencing them? Because that's how ridiculous this sounds. That you say, nope, don't want to talk politics, got somewhere to be. If you're Dick Brubaker, got to go sell some cars, sorry. That's not silencing them. They're still able to speak their mind. They can talk to whoever they want to that's willing to listen. But the idea that a public official must be beholden to every whim and every complaint of every individual and they must do so on whatever medium that that person deems necessary is insane. And here's another thing. Let's just say we'll use the media, because freedom of the press is also part of the First Amendment. If John Merrill is watching our news partners over at WSFA, if he's watching the 10 o'clock news, and he decides, well, I'm tired, time to go to bed, and he cuts their news broadcast off 5 minutes before it ends, is he silencing the media? Is he violating the free speech because he turned off the media? Because that's essentially what's happening on Twitter. He sees people saying things that he doesn't like, he turns them off, he walks away. How is that any different? If we're going to hold this standard that essentially, elected officials have to listen to commentary from people, whether it be news, whether it be private citizens, and if they don't want to hear it, if they walk away, then they are by definition silencing them, which is stupid. It's not like he stopped the broadcast. Now, if he did stop the broadcast, that would be a problem. But if he turns the TV off, that's not preventing that information from getting to other people. That's not silencing them. And so I used the same analogy on Twitter, and a guy that responded back, which actually I thought asked some good questions, a guy named HQ Bacon. And keep in mind, this is a Twitter handle, so you get some goofy names. But yeah, HQ Bacon said on Twitter, but if the news channel stopped Merrill as a citizen from seeing their broadcast against his will, wouldn't that be an issue? Actually, no, for a couple of reasons. First of all, when we're dealing with a TV broadcaster, well, that's a private company, and there are other ways to get their info. So even if they weren't a private company, even if they actually were a government TV station, like let's say it's PBS, let's say that it's them, even if they were a government station, as long as they disseminate this information through other mediums, then they're not preventing the person from seeing it. I mean, if you've got a radio station and a TV station, then you're just broadcasting out to the masses. If PBS, for example, wanted to block somebody on Twitter, I don't see why that would necessarily be a problem. He can still get all their content on the TV. He can still get all their content on the website. But if they're blocking him to keep him from commenting on their stuff because he's harassing them or for whatever reason, I don't see why that's a problem. And so this idea that you're not going to be able to get that information if you don't get it specifically from Twitter, that's just simply not true. And again, I don't see why you couldn't look up a person's tweets through other means anyway. I mean, if there's going to be a significant tweet, then you're going to see it on other mediums. For example, AL.com, they're going to report on those things anyway. And so there's other ways to get this information. Besides that, the Secretary of State, the State Department, has a website where you can get all the news and everything that's going on there. So this idea that they are keeping them from this information is simply not true. And even if it were, there's still other ways to get that information. And here's the other thing that he said afterward. He said, people on all sides would have a fit if a news broadcaster cut off communication to certain citizens. If people aren't violating the TOS of Twitter, they should have the ability to view John's tweets. He can just mute them. Well, there's two flaws in this argument. First of all, would people have a fit if there were broadcasters turning off their broadcast to certain TVs? Well, let's just theorize that they could do that, for example. Yeah, they would be upset, first of all, because they're paying for that service and they're not getting it. But here's the problem with that. People being mad is not the same thing as a law being violated. And this is something that we often fall into when we're arguing, especially on the internet. We act as though the question, we get away from the original question. The original question was, is this legal or illegal? Does it make sense to have this lawsuit levied against the Secretary of State? Well, people getting mad is not the same as something illegal being happening. I mean, I can be mad at people, but that doesn't mean they violated the law. And so the new standard that he presents when his old standard has been completely debunked is, well, what we need to do, what we're saying is that there are people that are angry out here and they would be angry if that happened. Well, maybe, but the whole point of having this discussion in the first place was we were supposed to be arguing whether or not this is legal or illegal, whether a lawsuit is justified or not justified. People being mad is not the same thing as saying a violation of the law has taken place. And here's another problem with that argument. What he's essentially doing now is not arguing for free speech, he's arguing for sunshine laws. The thing about the First Amendment is it guarantees you the right to speak, it allows you to offer a redress of grievances towards elected officials, but you have other means and other abilities to do that. Like I said, the man gives out his own personal cell phone number over radio broadcast and in newspapers. This is not somebody that is walling himself off and keeping anybody from commenting on what he's doing. And so he has plenty of mediums where you are able to actually do that and actually able to comment on it. But again, we've moved away from the original question. The original question was, is there a violation of the First Amendment? Is there a violation of these people's free speech? And is he silencing them by blocking them on Twitter? No. And what you're saying there is not a violation of the First Amendment. You could at best argue that it's maybe a violation of a sunshine law. Now, for those of you who don't know, and there's many, many different versions of these across the different states. It just depends on what state you're in. But sunshine laws are kind of an umbrella term that talks about laws that government must operate in the sunshine. In other words, government must be transparent. That when they do something, they have to make that information available to you, at least in some capacity. So at the very best, what we're doing now by saying, well, they can't see John's tweets. Well, maybe they can, maybe they can't. But again, there's other ways to get that information. But even if there weren't, what you are at that point doing is you're no longer arguing free speech. What you are arguing is a violation of the sunshine laws. And so it's easy to see how, especially when it comes to the internet, these debates, and you have to be careful about this, get really far away from what the original question actually was. And so even if that were the case, even if a violation of the Sunshine Law case had taken place, it doesn't change the fact that this lawsuit is still frivolous. Now, if they want to argue Sunshine Laws, maybe you could, and I could even maybe see a legal case for that being made here. But there's not a violation of free speech. there's no way that you can come up with a excuse for this being a violation of free speech, because you do not forego your ability to have a social media account and do with it what you please just because you're an elected official. The bottom line is that this is a frivolous lawsuit. What they're trying to do is they're trying to mimic the decision against Trump, which was different because it's a federal lawsuit in the first place. But even that ruling was just as stupid when they said, well, the president can't block people on his Twitter account. Yes, he can. It's his Twitter account. And the idea that you can't see President Trump's tweets if you don't see them specifically on Twitter is stupid. The man's tweets are everywhere. And that information is disseminated over many, many different media. They are not preventing you from seeing things. And again, even if they were, that's still not silencing you. You not being able to see something is not silencing. And the thing is, we're getting to that point that the ACLU is wasting its donors' money in pursuing this frivolous lawsuit, and they're wasting the time and money of the taxpayers, which is even worse, because it's going to be the state of Alabama that has to pay to defend this. So it's a massive, massive waste of time. It's a frivolous lawsuit. It's people that are just trying to make political hay against John Merrill. That's really the bottom line here. Look, if there's anybody that's actually being censored by the government, if there's ever a time where the government is actually censoring you, I will stand with you. I will stand with you, and I will use my own power, my own influence, little as that may be, on the radio waves to stand up for you. But there has to be an actual violation, and there has to be a government official actually keeping you from getting your opinion out there. Saying, well, they're not providing me a platform to get out there and give my speech is not the same thing as saying that you're being silenced. 860-1440, we'll be back in just a moment.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt, every weekday from 9 to 11, only on News Radio 1440 and newsradio1440.com.
Hebrews 13, 5 and 6. Make sure that your character is free from the love of money, being content with what you have. For he himself has said, I will never desert you, nor will I ever forsake you. So that we confidently say, the Lord is my helper, I will not be afraid. What will man do to me?
Welcome back. You're listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and newsradio1440.com. 860-1440 is the number if you want to weigh in. Don't forget, you're also welcome to tweet us at Tactics Radio. Have your tweets read on the air, just like HQ Bacon. I know everybody wants to be exactly like HQ Bacon and wants to get into a Twitter argument with me so it gets read on the air later. So be sure to do that later in the day if you get a little bit of time. A couple things that I did want to mention before we move on to our next topic. There is another sweet deal going on right now from News Radio 1440. You can get $50 worth of food from 1905 Fox's Pizza Den, and it's only going to cost you $25. That is starting Friday, December 21st at 8 a.m., so it actually just started, which means there's probably plenty of sweet deals still available, so be sure to check that out at newsradio1440.com right now and get yours. That's newsradio1440.com. $50 worth of pizza for $25, that is not a bad deal. You can feed an awful lot of people with $50 worth of pizza. You got a big family, that's something you need to do. And they actually delivered pizza to us the other day. That was where I had my lunch right after I got done with the show. I talked to Joe for about 30 minutes, and then we headed straight over and got some of the pizza they delivered. It was delicious. They had a meat lovers that was like, I think, sausage, bacon, pepperoni, and ham. Man, good pizza. So I highly recommend that. That is Fox's Pizza Deal. And you can check them out with their new name at 1905 Fox's Pizza Den in Prattville. So, getting back to the news of the day, Brett Kavanaugh's accuser is apparently in pretty thick with the Dems. And unfortunately, this is something that a lot of people are not surprised about, because this is sort of par for the course. This is kind of what we were expecting when it came to this. Even when it first came out, there was a suspicion that, especially because of the manner that it came out and the late hour in which it was put out, that this was seen as a big Hail Mary when it comes to trying to get Kavanaugh from being put on the court, from being confirmed. And so because of that, and because of the way that these allegations were brought forward by Senator Dianne Feinstein, it was highly suspicious that this was done purely for political motivation. And I'm not saying that that is absolutely true. I'm not saying that we know that 100% for a fact. But the longer this goes on and the more we find out about Dr. Christine Ford, his accuser, the more and more likely that seems. Because it seems at every turn we find out that she's even more in with the Democrats. We already knew that she was somebody that has donated to a number of left-wing causes. We already knew that she was one of the psychologists that actually signed that letter back in the day to try to get Donald Trump to stop the separations at the border. I'm not going to relive that issue in particular or say whether or not it was right or wrong for her to sign it, but it does show that she is somebody who is ideologically on the left. A lot of the social media posts that she deleted had to do with her meeting with people in the Democrat Party. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that she was somebody that was a high roller in the Democrat Party. I mean, there's pictures of me with Rick Santorum. That doesn't mean that Rick Santorum and I are best buddies. I imagine if I ran into Rick Santorum today, he would have no idea who I was. So I'm not saying that that means that she is necessarily a Democrat operative. I'm just saying that she at least understood that it was going to look suspicious and it was going to undercut the credibility of her story, which is part of the reason that she scrubbed a lot of this stuff. And a lot of her students that have been talked to and been reached said that she is someone that is ideologically on the left. That should really come as no surprise, considering she is a psychology professor in the state of California. I mean, that's about as left as it gets, a university professor in California. And so I'm sure while there are some people that have a more right-leaning affiliation that are professors in California, let's just be honest, as a group, as a whole, they tend to be people that are kind of far on the left. And the more that we learn about Dr. Ford, the more we understand that she seems to be a creature of the left that at the very least could have fairly strong political motivations for these accusations being made. So Democrat Senator Tammy Baldwin announced a fundraiser where Dr. Ford's attorneys were supposed to be appearing as special guests. That would be Deborah Katz and Lisa Banks, both of which have been used as left-leaning pundits on the ABC network or the Alphabet Soup networks, MSNBC, CNN, so on and so forth, ABC News. And so these are people that are well connected with the Democrat Party. So at the very least, the attorneys and the people representing Dr. Ford are very familiar with the Democrats. That's being a little overly generous, but let's just say that they definitely know the players in the Democrat Party and they are liked by them. They have worked with Democrats in the past. And they seem to be political animals when it comes to that. Deborah Katz and Lisa Banks both are well-known attorneys when it comes to the DNC. Now, this event was promptly canceled when that became public knowledge. So I think even Tammy Baldwin realized, wow, that looks really bad that both of the attorneys I'm having to fundraise with me at a political event. And this is kind of the same thing that we have seen with the Stormy Daniels story. That Stormy Daniels and her attorney, Michael Avenatti, have become kind of Democrat celebrities just because they are pushing a narrative that runs counter to the president's agenda, and also because people believe, I think wrongly, that this is going to be the nail in the coffin, that the Stormy Daniels allegation is going to be what gets Trump out of the White House. I don't believe that for a second, but there are a lot of Democrats that do believe it, and because of that, these guys are treated as celebrities. They're treated as heroes. And make no mistake, the attorneys here with Dr. Ford and Dr. Ford herself are also going to be treated as heroes when it comes to the left, if this winds up working, if this winds up being what keeps Brett Kavanaugh off the court, which again is hilarious because I don't even think Kavanaugh's all that conservative. I'm not saying that he's a left coast liberal or anything like that. I'm not saying that he's going to be Sonia Sotomayor. But I do think that ideologically on the court, he may be a little bit right of Roberts and a little bit left of Alito. And that's not exactly Neil Gorsuch or Clarence Thomas. And I'm fine if we get another Samuel Alito. That's okay with me. But my point is, it's hilarious to me that the Democrats are throwing absolutely everything they've got, playing every card that they have to try to keep Kavanaugh off the court when, by all measures, he's a fairly moderate Republican. I mean, as far as a Republican-appointed judge, he's about as moderate as it gets. I mean, I don't think that he's quite as far left as Kennedy. Kennedy was more in the middle. But even with Kennedy, the difference was Kennedy, everybody thought, was more conservative than he actually turned out to be. And that could be Kavanaugh. I really don't know. But the point in all of this is the left is really starting to lose their mind, and they are rallying around Dr. Ford, whether or not they actually believe her story, whether or not they think the story is true, because they believe that at the very least she is politically useful. And that really is disgusting. We're going to talk a little bit more about this, because there was a Politico story that kind of showed the same thing. The Politico has reported that Dr. Ford is being counseled by somebody that is very close to the Democrats. And this isn't The Blaze, this isn't The Daily Wire, this isn't Fox News, this is Politico reporting this. 860-1440, we'll be right back.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
The Bible is the best of all books, for it is the Word of God, and teaches us the way to be happy in this world and in the next. Continue, therefore, to read it and to regulate your life by its precepts. John Jay, First Supreme Court Chief Justice.
You're listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and newsradio1440.com. 860-1440 is the number if you want to weigh in, and we're going to go to the phones right now. Ben on line one, good morning.
Good morning, Caleb. You know these Democrackers, that was prejudicial, that was discriminatory, and that was racist. Sorry, don't drop me. The Democrats, you know, these far left, what I've seen, and I've said it before, you don't agree with them, then they like to throw the discrimination, prejudice, and racism around, wield it like a sword. And it's like you said, it may be used in the right context, but the wrong way.
Right. And that's the thing you have to be cautious about, because, and this is something that comes with being a communication person.
Yeah.
You don't just have the raw definition of the word. You also have the context that comes with the word. And so
Right. You
have to be aware of that. For example, when I say, we'll use something completely apolitical. When I say an odor, people think of a bad smell, even though the technical definition of odor is just a smell.
Exactly.
And so the same thing.
Yeah, I think on Kavanaugh, though, I've heard it, others say it, commentators, you know, talking about they're afraid they're going to overturn their right to murder young little babies, the Roe versus Wade. I really do think that's the main issue.
Well,
they don't even know, like you said about Kennedy, he could get in there, and you know, I mean, come on, he may not be as conservative as they think.
Right, and I think that that's the thing. This is my observation. I think this is much ado about nothing. I have serious doubts about whether or not Kavanaugh is actually going to overturn Roe v. Wade, and I wish that he would. I mean, obviously, people know where I stand on this. I would be fine with him going in guns a-blazing in the confirmation hearing saying, oh, I'm absolutely going to overturn it if given the opportunity.
Well, yeah, me too. And also, thank you, have the right to block anyone on Twitter or what Facebook. You know, what they did to you, you put up the Sodom and Gomorrah thing, and they what, dropped it?
Well, they deleted that particular post. Now, in Facebook's defense, they did restore it later, and they said, yeah, we made a mistake, and I reported that as well.
But did they have the right to do that?
I mean, they had the right to do it.
Legally.
Legally, yes, absolutely. Morally they had the right
wrong,
to do it.
Morally wrong, legally right.
Well, and that's the thing. I don't even think that it's necessarily morally wrong for, since you're talking about John Merrill, I don't think that it's morally wrong for him to necessarily block them. But even if it were, it's still not illegal.
No, I didn't mean that. I meant your Facebook they dropped. You know?
Right. Yeah, I know what you're talking about.
No, he has a right, and so does Trump. See, that's the thing. You don't agree with him, you disagree, and all of a sudden, they throw the discrimination, prejudice, and racism around.
You're right.
That's getting old.
Yeah, I mean, it is getting old because it's the only arrow in their quiver. That's the problem, is that when you can't win an argument, when you have no way to actually make your case from a logical perspective, it is pretty much impossible to win an argument that way. And so they do the next best thing, which is they just lob baseless insults and baseless accusations against people. And that's what they're doing with Kavanaugh now, or at least that's what it seems to be. And one of the reasons that I say that, and I do thank you for your call, Ben, is Politico is now reporting that Dr. Ford is being counseled by Ricky Sediman. Now, for those of you who don't know who that is, she was involved with bringing Anita Hill forward to testify against Judge Thomas, and she has worked for Senator Ted Kennedy and Joe Biden. Tried to combine Biden and Kennedy. Boy, that would be a monstrosity. But anyway, so when you're looking at this, the more that we learn about this woman, the more that we find that she actually is in pretty deep with the Democrats. They've got the same person that brought Anita Hill, a very similar situation, trying to keep Clarence Thomas off the Supreme Court. They've brought her back, and the same advisor, the same one that moved Anita Hill to go up and testify, is the one that is now advising Dr. Ford. This undermines this woman's credibility. I don't know whether or not the story she's telling is true, but the more political it seems, the less I believe that she's just doing this because she was attacked, that it's more a political motive.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt, every weekday from 9 to 11, only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.
We just need a strategy, okay?
Okay, here's the plan.
The line we're hearing from a lot of Democrats is we need to believe all the women, but do they practice what they preach? We talk about that now on Tactics. It is finally Friday. Ready for this weekend. I know that you are as well. 860-1440 if you want to weigh in, and you're also welcome to tweet me anytime that you want to, at Tactics Radio. That's always something that we want to give you plenty of opportunity to do, to get in touch with us. So let's look at this story. Here's the thing that really does drive me up a wall. We're hearing over and over again from Democrats and other people that are in general supporters of the Me Too movement. And again, just because the Democrats have a double standard does not mean that this woman's story is completely unable to be verified. Maybe they have proof. Maybe they have evidence. If they do, they need to present it and not just say that they have it. If they do, they need to have more than just a unsubstantiated claim from a witness with no evidence to back it up at an unspecified time, at an unspecified date, sometime in the summer of 1982. You got to have more to go on than that before that actually winds up blocking somebody and keeping someone off of the Supreme Court. Because if that's the case, then anybody anywhere could keep anybody out of any job. I mean, if that's the case, let's say that, I don't know, Elizabeth Warren becomes president. I know that's terrifying. And she nominates somebody and she has to go have one of her people go through the confirmation process, would they accept just some random person claiming sexual assault 36 years before it happened with nothing to back it up, saying, well, this happened to me, I don't know when, I don't know where, and the only witness that I can provide you is somebody else who says that it did not happen? Well, they would never accept that, and they shouldn't. And so there does seem to be a double standard from the Democrats on this. And the longer this goes on, the more we find out about this story, the more it looks like a manufactured political hit job. I hate to say that. I don't mean to discredit or dismiss it outright. But like I said, it could be true. But if that's the case, you have to provide evidence to back that up. And the Democrats really do seem to have a double standard when it comes to believing women in general, because, as you know, just a few weeks ago, Keith Ellison, who is the deputy chair of the DNC and is running for the attorney general spot in the state of Minnesota, his home state, he is someone who right now is being alleged to be a sexual assaulter, someone that was in a relationship with a woman and sexually assaulted her and abused her. And Ellison's former girlfriend, Karen Monahan, has just released medical records from this, and this goes along with the Democrats have had the same standard when it comes to the Clintons. For whatever reason, they'll believe all of the accusers against Donald Trump, but they won't believe any of the accusers with Bill Clinton. Now, frankly, I believe some of the accusers that has come out and they said that Donald Trump has done things. But I also believe a lot of the accusers with Bill Clinton, too, and that's really the double standard. If it is somebody that we politically like, we'll believe those accusers but not believe the other accusers. And Keith Ellison seems to be the latest rendition of that. His former girlfriend has released these records that are dated November 28th, 2017. So this is actually months before the story broke. I want to say that this story first broke. I know this is hard to gauge because it feels like an eternity when you're talking about news cycles, but I want to say that this story first broke maybe in June, certainly not before the summer. It would have been May or June for sure. And so these records are dated November 28th, 2017. So this is a significant amount of time before the story actually was opened up. And this is a quotation from this whole thing. It states that she was in a very stressful environment for years, emotionally and physically abused by a partner with whom she is now separated. She identifies the individual she was involved with as Congressman Ellison, and she is worried about retribution that she if she identifies publicly. So this is notes taken from a therapist, a mental health professional, that is specifically saying that she was talking about Ellison, and that she is showing signs of emotional and physical abuse from that partner, the partnership that she had with Congressman Ellison. Now, does this absolutely mean that it is true? Again, I'm not sure. But this is pretty strong evidence. And, well, I would say moderately strong evidence, maybe not pretty strong evidence. This is moderately strong evidence, because it is something that she has confided in before this became a story, before it seemed that she wanted to do so. And if you're comparing this to what's happening with Dr. Ford, she has an actual time, she has an actual location where this happened, and in her story, the notes that she has with her therapist are much more recent. I mean, we're talking about literally less than a year ago, as opposed to 36 years ago. And another thing that we have that corroborates her story is that she specifically mentioned Ellison with her therapist. And the therapy sessions that Christina Ford is talking about that happened about 5 or 6 years ago, I think she said, yeah, it would have been in 2012. So a little less than 6 years, I believe, if you're looking at the month that it happened. So if you're looking at that, then she has some discrepancies, where Christina Ford says this happened and the only people in the room were Brett Kavanaugh and Mark Judge. The notes from the therapist say that she claimed originally it was 4 people. And some of the story doesn't check out when you're matching the two against each other. Her story lines up when you're talking about the woman accusing Ellison. And so I'm not saying that this is absolute concrete proof, but it is way more than Christine Ford has. It's far more recent. There's far more evidence. There's far more specifics. And there's corroboration that she has told this story before it became a national news story. Ford can't even prove that she met Kavanaugh. She cannot even prove that she knew the man in high school. With Ellison, there's pictures of these two together. And so again, I'm not saying that this absolutely proves that this one's true and the other one is false, because I don't know that. But what I am saying is, if you're comparing the two and looking how the Democrats are treating Christine Ford as incredibly credible and somebody that absolutely should be believed, and then you're looking at the way that they're treating Ellison and saying, oh, well, there's no truth to that. All the DNC has said is, we'll look into it. That's the extent of what they have done. And yet with Brett Kavanaugh, they're saying that this guy should be immediately have his, we played the clip from Richard Blumenthal yesterday, saying that the nomination should be completely withdrawn from President Trump, specifically because of these claims that are being put out there, despite the fact that if you're looking at Keith Ellison, who actually is the deputy chair of the DNC, those claims are far more credible. There is far more evidence to support that than there is anything Christine Ford. You can't even prove that you met Brett Kavanaugh or ever knew him. That's how flimsy that is. And so Monahan said, the fact that both parties only care if it scores political points is hypocritical. Do you think a person who has dealt with any form of abuse by politicians is thinking about politics? No. We and our families are trying to heal. So here's the other thing that I think plays into this. She is not somebody that is doing this just to make political hay, because she's a Democrat, and she's someone who is a lifelong Democrat, and you can look at, you know, who she has been and who she supported over the years. That's probably part of the reason that she was attracted to Ellison, is because he's a very big figure in the Democrat Party in the first place. And she does not speak highly of Republicans, so the idea that she is doing this for some kind of political game, it doesn't look like she's doing it for political gain. I mean, it's hard to make that case, whereas Christina Ford whether or not she's telling the truth or not, you could make the case that she is doing this specifically because she believes that Brett Kavanaugh would not be a good person to have on the court for her because of her own political affiliation. You can't make that case with this woman. Again, I don't know if what she's saying is credible or not, but it seems pretty solid that whatever it is that she's doing, whatever it is that she's claiming, is not being claimed because she has something against Keith Ellison's political agenda. She's a Democrat. She's on board with the Democrat agenda. She just doesn't like Ellison because she's accusing him of abusing her, which, if that took place, is understandable. And here's another thing that we have. The further that we go into this, like I said, the less credible it seems. The media really had a field day the other day with a lady named Christina King Miranda. And the reason that they did is because she posted this on Twitter. I graduated from Holton Arms and knew both Brett Kavanaugh and Mark Judge. Christina Baisley Ford was a year or so behind me. I remember her. I signed the letter. The incident was spoken about for days afterward in school. Kavanaugh should stop lying, own up to it, and apologize. Well, I mean, if you're the media and you're against Ford being on the court, you do have a field day with this because you're thinking, oh my gosh, the first contemporaneous witness, somebody that's saying that they did hear this story and there was chatter about this for days afterward around school, that they were talking about this happening. And she says, Kavanaugh should stop lying, own up to it, and apologize. This is someone who was actually there. We can get in touch with this person. Well, they did, and they interviewed her. This is her in an interview with NPR.
That it happened or not, I have no idea. I can't say that it did or didn't. In my post, I was, you know, empowered, and I was sure it probably did. I had no idea that I would have to now, you know, go to the specifics and defend it before 50 cable channels and have my face spread all over MSNBC News and Twitter.
So she has no idea whether it happened or not. She's saying that and admitting in this radio interview, I don't know, I was talking about something I had no idea about. I had no idea that I was going to have to actually defend it. Which, what does that mean about this woman? It means that this woman did what most Americans do on social media, which is post about crap they don't know. And I hate to categorize it that way, but that's how it is. And we all know people like this. They post things on social media they know were not true. But they didn't think that they would actually be called to task for it and have to actually defend it. And that's exactly what this woman did. She reacted on social media like most people on social media react to things. That she didn't think she was actually going to have to defend it and actually say, oh, okay, yeah, well, I really don't have anything. I'm sorry. When I said that, I didn't mean that I actually knew anything about this. This story didn't circulate. I was just making it up. Which, by the way, ought to be a lesson to everybody. Be careful what you post on social media. Because she's saying, well, I didn't think that I'd have to defend it and have my face plastered all over these different cable news channels. Well, then you shouldn't have posted it. Don't act like the victim here. You did this intentionally. You're the one that came down with this absolute moral authority that Kavanaugh was wrong and he needs to apologize. Yeah, well, the solution to that is don't post that. If you don't know something, don't lie on social media. That's the moral of the story here. And unfortunately, this is a pretty common occurrence for people on social media. It's kind of the norm, honestly. But this is why you do not post about things you do not know about. And I love the justification there. Well, I felt empowered. Yeah, well, unfortunately, that's what happens to a lot of people is because they have an outrage, they have a moral indignation that they want to post about something. They just post it whether or not it actually happens to be true. The truth is not the primary thing. The fact that you feel empowered, that you feel good, that there's a catharsis when saying something like that, that is the motivation, and that's the reason that most people post what they do on social media. There is no thought about, wonder if this is true or not. Maybe I shouldn't post this. They are spreading false information, and the explanation that is given here is that, well, I felt empowered. It felt good. This is part of the larger narrative that the Democrats are going to be putting forward, which is women are victims, and because Brett Kavanaugh is a man, and because women are victims here, and they have been oppressed by men in the past. Doesn't matter that whether or not Brett Kavanaugh actually did anything or not. Doesn't matter whether this woman was actually sexually assaulted or not. Women are victims, and they're the ones that are innocent, and they're the ones that are to be believed, and men are the ones, and the reason they have shifted this narrative is because you can tell they've got nothing. The reason they have shifted the narrative to men versus women as opposed to this particular woman versus this particular man is because it seems as though they are hedging themselves because even they believe that they don't have any evidence to back this up. And so now the narrative is going to be, and we played just the other day with Anna Marie Cox, basically saying it doesn't even matter whether or not he actually did it or not. What matters is whether or not he feels a woman's pain. So again, what they're going to try to do is they're going to try to take this to the meta level. They're going to try to make the case that because all women are victims and because all women need to be believed, that we should side with this woman over Brett Kavanaugh simply because she is a woman and he is a man. Which, by the way, is the literal textbook definition of sexism. 860-1440. We'll be right back.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Philippians 3:20. For our citizenship is in heaven, from which also we eagerly wait for a Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ.
Glad to be back with you. Before we get you to the weekend, Chaplain's report today comes from 1 Corinthians 10, verses 11 through 13. And here Paul is writing to the church at Corinth, has had quite a few problems. You have to keep in mind that Corinth was a predominantly Greek church, so there were a lot of Gentiles. There was not a lot of instruction in the Jewish law. They were not people that were familiar with living a certain way. They were not people that were familiar with God. And so because of this, because this is who they were, they really did struggle with a lot of sin and a lot of temptation. And I had a conversation with a friend not too long ago that really reminded me of how important this verse was to me when I was going through some of my struggles with my health, when I had the blood clots, when I had the cancer. This verse really did help me get through quite a bit. And it's one of my favorite verses in the Bible. So in 1 Corinthians 10, 11 through 13, "Now these things happened to them as an example, and they were written for our instruction, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. Therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed that he does not fall. No temptation has overtaken you, but such as is common to man. And God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond that which you are able, but with the temptation will provide a way of escape also, so that you will be able to endure it." And so, Paul is talking about these stories that have happened in the past, and he's also talking about, and he just quotes part of what has happened to Israel. Because keep in mind, these are people that don't really know the law of Moses. They're not well-versed in it. It's not like Jewish Christians that have been accustomed to following God's law their entire life. To them, becoming a Christian was a big transition, but not nearly to the point that it was for people that were pagans that were unfamiliar with God and unfamiliar with his character and his instructions in the Bible. They didn't know anything about that, and so this was a very big transition for them. And he's saying, look at all of these things that happened in Israel. Look at the mistakes that were made in the past and the good things that were happened. He said that when these things happen to people in the Old Testament, these things are written for your instruction. They're written so you can better understand who God is and why it's important to follow his rules, important to follow his laws. Don't make the same mistakes of the past. Know your history. And because he has that message, he's saying that, look, all the terrible things that happened with them, everything that they went through, didn't it all work out for the better? Didn't it all end up with Jesus Christ being born from the seed of Abraham and coming forward and dying for the sins of the world? Didn't it all work out okay? And look at the people that were faithful to God, the people that even when Israel was making stupid mistakes, still followed God's law. They were able to live righteously, even in a time where the people around them weren't righteous, which is something that the Greek Christians would have understood. They were living in places where people were involved in all kinds of sin and idolatry and debauchery. And he's saying, if they could do it, if the prophets of old could do it, then you can do it too. These things were written specifically for your instruction on how to do that. And this last part that he says here, he says, these people were not free from temptation. It was not as though there was no temptation around them that they had to risk falling down. He says, so don't be proud. Don't think that you're standing up above the community. Don't put yourself on a pedestal. Acknowledge that you have weaknesses. Acknowledge that you can be tempted and you can fall down as well. But then also remember that even though that is a possibility, that God is going to be faithful. And that any temptation that you're facing, God is not allowing you to face a temptation that you are incapable of overcoming. That to me was a great source of comfort, because it meant whether it's something that I did, a circumstance that I caused, or it's something that's just kind of a force of nature, whether it's a storm or a hurricane, whether it's you losing your job or coming down on the wrong side of a depression or a financial problem, or something like I had, getting cancer. Whatever temptation comes your way, God has already provided an escape, that there is no temptation that you are going to be facing that is too much for you to handle. It may be too much for you to handle alone, but that's why Paul says that God is faithful and he is going to be with you. These temptations are not insurmountable, especially when we have God with us. Stay the course, friends.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt, every weekday from 9 to 11, only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.